And it's somewhere in between Kriyas Yam Suf, which is on 21 Nisan, and Matan Torah, which is on Vav Sivan. But somewhere in between those 6-7 weeks, that's where we are. They arrive at this location called Mara. And at Mara, two things happen. Number one, there's no water, but it seems as if it's not a big rebellion with complaints and what's happening to us, and there's no graves in Egypt, and all that stuff happened before, it happened after. Mara sounds like we're thirsty, and Hashem says, okay, here's some water, and Moshe sweetens the water with the tree. Is it on the board or something?
Yeah.
Okay. The second thing that happens in Mara... okay. The second thing that happens in Mara is Sham Samlo Choko Mishpat V'Sham Nisal. Now, the simple reading of Sham Samlo Choko Mishpat V'Sham Nisal means that in Mara, when they finally had a little time to breathe, Moshe taught them what it would take to survive in the desert. This is the Ramban. What type of society they would build in the desert. After all, they're refugees. You've seen what happens in refugee camps. A lot of violence, a lot of rape, a lot of filth, a lot of... So we're going to live now in the desert for a couple of weeks, at least according to the original plan. Okay? In the end, it ended up being 40 years. So they need to establish certain patterns, policies. They're not going to... When people visit from traveling caravans, we're not going to behead them or pirate them. We're going to treat them properly. And of course, the struggle for the desert. Not as if everything's going to be miraculous all the time. You'll be thirsty sometimes. You'll have to have faith in HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So Moshe is preparing them. Sham Samchol Mishvot Sham Nisau. And it fits with the story of Marcus. And of water, now's a good time to talk about what this journey will be like. Until now, it's all been a lot of pyrotechnics and Mitzrayim and Yam Suf and miracles. And now reality's setting in. We need water. Hashem gives us water. It's not always going to be so easy. We're going to have to buy from passing caravans. We're going to have a camp. We're going to have people, a community. So this is what the Ramban says, more or less. Moshe is establishing the plan, the road plan, for being in the desert. Chazal say that no. That at Mara, HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered, practice mitzvahs. In a couple of weeks, they're going to stand at Har Sinai. In a couple of weeks, they're going to listen to 613 mitzvahs. Hashem says, try on a few of these mitzvahs for size. Just take a practice run. Here's a couple of mitzvahs, a sampling of mitzvahs. Just so you should get oriented towards mitzvahs and oriented towards commandments and oriented towards submitting your will. So sham, especially those words, chok u'mishpat, sounds like it's something more religious and ritual, not just general guidelines for survival in the desert. Chok u'mishpat v'sham nisau. So also sounds like there's some test here. It's a training ground for Har Sinai. Okay, so what are the mitzvahs that Hashem delivered to them in Mara, according to Chazal? So Rashi quotes the Medrash, Shabbos. That makes a lot of sense. It's hard to imagine Am Yisrael standing at Har Sinai without keeping Shabbos or thinking about Shabbos or remembering Hashem created the world. I mean, they're segueing into a whole new period of Jewish history. Hashem delivered them from Mitzrayim. Hashem commanded. Hashem is the lawgiver. But the first part of our relationship with Hashem is He created us and He created our world. And every Shabbos we remember that He created us. And every Shabbos and that He rested from work and He made room for us. So it makes sense. Makes sense that for a Jew, it's so basic to Jewish identity that they can't stand at Har Sinai without, again, they're not chayiv in Shabbos yet, but experimenting with it, tasting it, feeling it, learning about it. The second part that Rashi says is dinim. That also makes sense. You can't have a lawless, anarchist people running around, stealing from one another without the rule of law. There's a dignity to accepting HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah, and that dignity is maintained by civil order and social justice and the judicial system and responsibility, accountability. So that makes sense. It makes sense that before Har Sinai, there should be both human morality stress. Even without Har Sinai, I have to be a good person. Don't think the morality is not because Hashem commanded it. Also instinctively have to act properly. And also at a social level, that we should have a society, rudimentary. It's not like Parshas Mishpatim was delivered yet, but basic. And of course, according to Chazal, dinim or mitzvos that even Gentiles have. So it's not as if it was a big discovery. But now we're segueing. Just make sure that you've been slaves for 210 years. You can get a little greedy. You can get a little selfish. Just make sure that you act polite and respectful to other people. But the third mitzvah, that mitzvah is very, very odd. The third mitzvah they're given to try out, to toss around a little bit, is the mitzvah of paraduma. Paraduma? Why in the world would they have paraduma? They didn't have a cow. They didn't have a base on mikdash to actually process the paraduma. They didn't even need the paraduma because until Har Sinai, no one was really tame. Tumah is halachic state. It's very, very interesting. When people describe tumah, So the natural word that comes about is impure. It's really not true. You're not impure. You could be doing the biggest mitzvah in the world. In English, the connotations are impure is unholy and sullied. And unfortunately, when we start talking about, especially women, a woman who's anitas tamei, and you translate it to English, it doesn't carry well because you're not impure. It's the most natural thing in the world. If I touch a sheretz, because I have to, let's say I bury somebody, I'm tamei. I'm the most kaddish person in the world. I did a great mitzvah. So it's hard to, tumah is halachic state. There's nothing inherent. Before halacha, there's no tumah. Halacha says if you come into contact with the following items, you are ritually unsuited for certain places and activities. Same with a woman who's anita, she's ritually unsuited for relations. Let me try not to use the word impure because it's very pejorative and the connotations sound very, very degrading. Is that true? Okay, so it's tumah. But again, no one's tamei. So you don't need a paraduma. You don't have access to paraduma. They're not calling him yet. So just the whole thing just doesn't sit right. Why are they practicing with paraduma? So to solve this question, Rav Amital told us the following story, Miseches Kiddushin. And by better understanding this famous story, he turned us back to this Rashi to help us better understand why we were delivered paraduma. So the Gemara in Kiddushin is discussing Kibbut Avein, and to highlight how natural and how instinctive and how obvious Kibbut Avayim is, let's study even Gentiles who perform Kibbut Avayim. Famous story of Dama ben Asina. Very often you'll see Chazal being inspired by moral behavior by non-Jews. Okay? Very important. Over the next couple of years, wherever you go, you're going to meet a lot of very inspiring people. Hopefully you meet a lot of very inspiring Jews. Hopefully many of them will be religious Jews. But you're also going to meet very inspiring people. Non-religious Jews, people. Try to be inspired by people of morality in whatever form they take. They don't have to be Jewish. They don't have to be from. Try not to be inspired by people of intelligence and smarts. And just that'll get you into a bad place. So you'll meet a lot of professors in university. They'll impress you by how smart they are. And don't go ahead. Smarts doesn't get you really far in this world. It gets you a lot of money if you want a good job. But real things that matter, like relationships and values and smarts doesn't get you. So don't like all of a sudden, especially those of you who end up in university, in Israeli universities in particular, there is a culture of arrogance and of condescension and holier than thou. Don't fall for that, okay? I went to university, met a lot of professors who really inspired me with their lives, and I enjoyed sitting in their classroom and trying to get to see them and feel them and learn about life through them and just some other people I didn't care for. I didn't care how much they knew. They don't impress me with your knowledge. It doesn't impress me. So be careful, on the one hand, not to close your mind to sources of inspiration. If there are people that inspire you, they don't have to be Jewish. On the other hand, be inspired by the right thing. So Dama ben Asina demonstrates Kibbut Avayim. And as I told you a couple of weeks ago, Kibbut Avayim is a mitzvah which you absolutely, positively cannot learn from a Shulchan Aruch. You can know the Shulchan Aruch of Kibbut Avayim backwards and forwards and what you have to do, what the mitzvah is. It will not help you. You need to see people who have practiced Kibbut Avayim and you use as your role model. There's only one way. That's why when you have that opportunity, you should try to observe those people. If they've been your parents, you can see it in your parents, the way they take care of their parents. If not your parents, then you can see it in other people. But it's the type of mitzvah, because relationships are so charged and the responsibilities are so immense, it's not something that, oh, I know what the halachas are and I'm a firm person. It's not going to help you. Just like in Sefer Bereishis, who excels in Kibbut Avayim? Esav. Who doesn't? Yaakov. So everything's upside down. They're no fault of their own. It's not Yaakov's fault. It's not Esau's. It's just, Kibbut Avayim is like an island. You either succeed in it, you don't, and it's not based on how well you know the halachos. It's how much selflessness you can bring, and how much love you can bring, and how much role modeling you have. That's all. So, let's look at Dama ben Asina, the Gemara says. What happened to Dama ben Asina? One day, Dama discovered these huge, huge gemstones. The Kohen wore type of an apron. It's like a harness. It's called the ephod. And on this apron, he had the choshen, which was a breastplate with a lot of gems, small little diamonds and gems in it. And then the choshen was tethered to his shoulders. These two gold straps came up from the edge of the choshen and were held in place on his shoulders by Avnei HaShoam. But these very, very, very large gemstones. So those were very expensive. These little jewels you could find in passing caravans. But these big ones were hard to come by. Two of them. Six of one shaven on one, six of the other shaven on the other. One day, this Dama, who lived in Ashkelon, who was a Gentile, happened to find these two big gemstones. So he was visited by the Machon HaMikdash. He was visited by the people assembling the big Dei Kahuna. And they offered him a lot of money. They pulled up with suitcases of cash. Here we are. They didn't have cash in those days. But here we go. Come with the suitcases. Problem is, his father is sleeping, and his father is sleeping on the key to the safe where the jewels are stored. Now, I want everyone to listen carefully to me. Okay, I'll never say this ever again. This is a one-time event. It will only happen once. This is the one Gemara you should absolutely, positively not listen to. Okay? Dama doesn't wake his father up. On behalf of all the fathers and mothers in the world, if someone comes to the house with suitcases of cash, please wake me up. Okay? Please, don't follow this Gemara. Okay? Oh, my father's sleeping. You wake us up for a lot of other Narish cake, okay? Oh, all of a sudden, Abba's sleeping. Please, wake me up, pour water, tickle my feet, drag me out of bed if you have to, burn the house down, okay? I'll build a new one. People come with suitcases, don't get all pious. Oh, my dad's sleeping, okay? Whatever reason, Dhamma makes the wrong call. But trust me, don't listen to us, okay? I speak on all behalf of all the parents. Wake us up. The father's sleeping, passes on the money. What's his reward? Well, we know the first part of the story. Well, we've all heard the story. What's the second part of the story? Next year, out of his reward, he gets a paraduma. Okay. Now that he gets a return visit from the Chachamim, but this time it isn't suitcases, it's trucks. They're bringing the Briggs trucks with cash in it. They're pulling up in front of his house because it's not a million, now it's 10 million. Now it's 10 million for the paraduma. You think you had a hit jackpot last year, now you hit the double, what do they call it in America? The Powerball. You hit the Powerball jackpot. Pulling up with Brinks trucks, lining up one after the other to pay him money. He says, you know what? I know I could ask you for the 10 mil, but I'm not. Just pay me the $1 million I've waived or forfeited last year for Kibbutz Avayim. Effectively, I'll take Kibbutz Avayim money, a million, but don't give me paraduma money. That's how the Gemara ends. You can see it. Why is the Gemara telling us this like terrible negotiation of Dhamma ben Hussein? He's like negotiating against himself. Okay, give me less, but I want more. Give me less. I got it wrong. He's supposed to ask for more. Like, what do we care? What's he up to and why do we care? So Rav Amital explained as follows. This Dhamma ben Hussein was an honest person. He said, look, I'm a religious man, but in my religion, there's only room for rational mitzvahs. I get Kibbutz Avayim, it makes sense to me. And last year I went to the mat for Kibbutz Avayim, so I deserve to be paid for it. But in my religion, there is no room for irrational mitzvahs. Paraduma makes no sense to me. I don't feel honest. I don't feel right taking money for something that doesn't make sense to me. So I don't deserve paraduma. Give me Kibbutz Avayim. That I'll take. The paraduma money, I'm not. Why should the burnt ashes of a red cow sprinkled on the third and seventh day create Tara? And not only that, it's not only illogical. Sometimes we face illogic in life, but we enter the system and we at least look for some consistency. Paraduma is not just illogical, it's also incongruent, asynchronous, because the person who confers the tahara, the Kohen who performs the ceremony, he becomes Tameh. So it's an enigma within a riddle. It's not just that it's illogical, but it's not consistent. It's all jagged. Nothing makes sense. So for me, that I don't feel honest taking money for that. I'll take Kibbutz Avayim money, not paraduma money. What makes Judaism so powerful and so difficult is this blend between ration and mystery, between reason and illogic. And it's hard, I know, because we live in a very empirical world and we're lessened, we're indoctrinated not to accept scientifically anything we cannot prove empirically, scientifically, and can't understand. And religion is a shift. Religion is the ability to understand some things and understand other things. And as you go through life, you'll understand more about Torah, and some things you'll understand less of. But it's not just true about Torah. It's true about life and faith, and not just in the book, but in the book of life. And there are things in this world that will make sense to you, and then hopefully you'll all live good, healthy, happy lives. But there are things that will happen in your life you can't make sense of, either on a personal level or on a national level. And faith has to start. That's why it's so hard. Faith has to start with a leap. The ability to accept things you can't understand. And the ability to operate under the influence of things you can't understand, the ability to invest in things you can't understand. Normally, when we understand something, we invest in it. Well, it has to make sense to me. Now that it makes sense to me, I'm willing to. The greatest decisions in life are the decisions you can't prove. Mirat Hashem, you get married, there's no way you're going to prove that that marriage is going to work. You just feel very deep trust and deep love, and you say, you know what, I'm going to go for it. And the most redeeming decisions in life are the decisions that you cannot prove. You cannot, there's no algorithm for them. And the problem, and I understand the problem in this world, the problem is the only way you can walk into the unknown. And walking into the unknown in life, not just in religion, in growth is the ticket for change, for advance. If you want to be, if you want to stay within your comfort zone in life, you will be mediocre. It's built into life. If you stay where you are, the here and now, the familiar, this thing you're secure in, then you will. I remember I worked for IBM in 1986, and it was a very advanced group, and we're very excited, and we built an internet, like we built the internet, and just, it took me like 2 hours to realize I don't want any part of this culture. Because what was this culture? Don't ask questions, follow instructions, be a good employee, and every 3 years you'll get a 3% raise. I said, I am so out of here. Let's burn this house down. Like that is not the life I want for myself. Follow my superior, follow orders, listen to everyone around me. So I'll be a 50-year-old man. I'll just 3 years of increase every year. And I won't change. I won't grow. I won't meet any excellence. To be excellent, you have to go somewhere you're not. You have to find something that isn't there. That will always be challenging because it's unknown. And the way that you walk into the unknown, whether it's in development, whether it's in religion, to commit to religion, you have to, and it's so hard today because you don't have it in our world, you have to learn how to trust people. And it's very hard because we live in an age of distrust for so many reasons. I'm not even going to go into the reasons. We're very critical thinking. We're very... My daughter just got married last week, so obviously I'm thinking back at raising my kids, okay? The worst thing you can train your kids to be is critical thinkers. Hear what I just said? I'm trying intentionally to de-brainwash you. Because you think that's the most important trait. It isn't. It is a trait. It will come. You should try to build it. But too many people put the wagon before the horse. And they try to turn their children into critical thinkers before they turn their children into believers. I don't just mean believers in faith and ideology, to believe in something. Because those two traits are at loggerheads. Because belief is enthusiasm, acceptance, awe, excitement. Critical thinking is, let me see, I'm not so sure, let me think about it from a different angle. And I've seen people who work very, very hard to train their kids to be critical thinkers before they train them to just believe in something, to be excited. I remember my kids went to school in the area. Many of their teachers were more, let's say, politically hawkish, fanatical than I would be. And many of them came from, let's say, religious environments that were not exactly calibrated to my synchronicity, to my frequency. I never, ever, ever disagreed in public with my kids about anything my teachers told them. Nothing was worth it. The differences were so marginal that it wasn't worth it to de-cleat my teacher's authority and to pull the rug out from under my kids' teachers, because I would lose so much more. I would lose their ability to be excited about religion, to be excited about ideas, to buy into ideas. The only time I intervened was when Sharon, when Ariel Sharon, after the hit Natkut, he had a stroke, remember that? And my kids told me that they were dancing, not them, but their friends were dancing out of happiness because this was his comeuppance for the Hitnat Kut. I said, that, you know, that's so ugly. That's so odious. I have to step in and say that's wrong. So obviously there's a red line, but it has to be very extreme. And don't get it wrong. I think our community gets it wrong. We're so engrossed and so excited about critical thinking and three ways to look at something. And I'm not sure, what do you think? And we try to debate issues at the table and we're interested in courteous and respectful debate. Where we are deprogramming belief, we're deprogramming, we're emptying trust. And because of so many other factors, it's hard, I know it's hard for you to trust. Like, who do you really trust in this world? Who would you trust blindly? Who have you met that just, that person has integrity, nobility of character, wisdom? If they say, I feel bad for you, I really do, because I had someone like that. I met Rav Lichtenstein, and he was just so impressive and so overwhelming and so otherworldly, they basically just gave up and said, I trust you. I'll do what you tell me to do. And it wasn't that, I didn't have that conversation with him. But almost as if I let go of my own authorship of life, He said, "What the life that you're leading me towards, I trust it will make my life better." And just fill in the dots. Just give me the code book. Give me the handbook and let me write my life the way I think you want me to lead the life. And I trusted him. He's a man of unassailable integrity and unassailable piety, and just someone who I just look at and say, okay, this is a person not gonna betray my trust, and it's someone who's worth trusting. But that's the only way you buy into something you can't make sense of. And that's why Masara is so important, and that's why belonging to Masara, we've talked about this before, when women's issues, and I hate to say women's issues, but issues relating to women's role in society, because they're not women's issues, they're communal issues, when they come up, undoubtedly, that word's going to come up. And people are going to say, like, why are you telling me Masara as opposed to Halacha or Minhag, right? And I keep telling you, religion is a three-legged table. The most powerful leg is Halacha. There's another leg called Minhag. What is our Minhag? There's a third leg called Masara. And Masara is not a Minhag, but it's a feel and a sense and a belonging. And it's obviously the easiest thing to change, but it's the thing that's most ambiguous. But sometimes it's most powerful because, right, for example, if your house doesn't smell from chicken soup Friday afternoon, you'd have a hard time because it's a smell. Let me give you a different example, okay? Someone conducted a study a couple years ago, okay, that families that sing Zemiros together on Shabbos, I don't know what the end of the study was, okay, they continue to sing Zemiros, but whether they stay together as families or the kids turn out to be more dati. It was something in that space. Now, Zemiros is not Halacha, and Zemiros is it really, it's probably somewhere between Minhag and Masara, but these things that aren't hard, fast, rational, concrete, empirical, scientific, they tug at you, they pull at you. They create identity. They create belonging. And we're not good at that sometimes as a people, as a culture, as an era. And that's what Rav Avital was trying to give us. And he gave it to us by belonging through him to an old world. Like he would speak, to us in Yiddish, and then he would translate. He was bringing us to a world that we belonged to, that he felt we were changing certain elements of, but we still were associated with. And that's why Moshe Rabbeinu gave Am Yisrael, Hashem gave Moshe three mitzvahs. He said, look, there's one mitzvah that you make sense of. One mitzvah is so basic to Jewish identity, Shabbos. But you cannot condition yourself to religion unless you start to practice mitzvahs that you can't understand and that you just have to buy into. And that's why, listen to the following statement. Why do you think the quintessential chok, paraduma, the quintessential irrational mitzvah, paraduma, quintessential ceremony, paraduma, applies to death? Because when we reach death, we realize there are certain conditions in the human realm that we just don't have answers to. We don't have answers to death. So when we become tameh through death, it's obvious that we need answers from a different realm. It's obvious that we don't possess the answers. It's symbolic. Obviously, we're not trying to resurrect the person. But we come into contact with death, we know we're facing something we don't understand. So it's obvious to us that we need Hashem to swoop in with his logic that we can't get to and to relieve us of death or to release us of the tumor that's associated with death. That's why, because Hashem's giving us a message, you should extrapolate from death that even in life, there are parts of life you just won't get, you won't understand. And do you have the courage and the faith and the trust to submit? Now, how you'll calibrate those two, each person will be different. In different stages of your life, in different parts of your life, but you have to have that internal calibration. If you're only looking to prove God, religion, tradition, ideology, mitzvahs, based on meaning, how it means, you won't get anywhere. At some point, you're going to fail. And you have to have that voice inside. I don't know where it's going to come from, but hopefully it'll come from here, and hopefully it'll come to Rabbein from here, and your background and your parents. I was just having a conversation with someone yesterday. Someone asked me whether the following boy should be accepted to the yeshiva. I forget even what the question was. One of the younger rabbis asked me just for my two cents. I said, I can't really say I haven't met the boy, but structurally, this is what I would say. The boy's questions, whatever. I said, if he's coming from a strong household and he's going back to a strong Torah environment, then you should probably shade favorably. Because how much can we really give a kid in 8 months in yeshiva, or 9 months in yeshiva? It's not even a year. Come for 8 months. 1, 5, and 2. You go off to Camp Snow, right? 1, 5, or Moshe. Right? No one's staying a whole year anymore. So you have to factor in what is our program in yeshiva, what are we giving, what are we not giving, and we'll be able to change the boy. Like a very often, I was always accused of, throughout all the years that I was in admissions, of accepting boys or not accepting boys based on college. And the truth is, I rarely ask colleges. I don't even know where most of the kids are going. But every once in a while, I'll ask the college. Why? Because it's part of the equation. If a kid comes to like the strongest religious home in the community, okay, so there's a strong rooting. But let's say, you know, the parents are not from, or, you know, there's a broken home or something, and he's ending up in the University of Wichita or something, and he's here for 8 months. So this is not a punishment for the kid in his college choice. I know if the factor in, given his background, given his future, are we the place that can really touch his soul? We'll be able to touch his soul by teaching him a lot of Rashbas all day, given his background, given his future. If I don't conduct that screening, it's malpractice. He can come for 8 months in yeshiva and learn a lot of Rashbas, but that's not going to help anyone. It's not going to help him any. So I have to factor in where he's coming from. So to a degree, it has to do. And again, we're cycling so far ahead feministically that we're skipping steps. Who gives this grounding in the house? You guys. And if you're going to replace that grounding, I remember Aaron Soloveitchik, my Rebbe, you know, told us, he just started blurting out one year, my mother, he told me in his very, very deep Lithuanian, my mother taught me Tanakh and taught me Halacha and taught me this and taught me that and taught me Emunah. Like, he rifled off everything his mother had taught him before he even like talked about his father, who just happened to be one of the greatest Gedolim of the generation. Okay, so how much information? It's important for you to be able to one day learn with your daughter for a bat mitzvah. Great. So, but there's so many other ways that you can create identity and belonging and faith. And like, ask yourself, this year, how did you get faith? Who gave you faith? And how will you give your children faith? That's a harder question to crack than how will you teach your kids Maseches Sanhedrin. That's the easy stuff. And we're exposing you to Maseches Sanhedrin because in today's world, hopefully that will intensify faith and commitment and belonging, because if you're an outsider, but sometimes it replays, especially for smart girls, and you're all smart girls, you get into that brainy thing. You just get caught in your own brain, and you know, you're good, you get your pencil, you get your notebooks, you get your scores, and why didn't I get 110? I only got 109.5, and that's the most important thing in the world. I know what it is to be a straight arrow. I've never been a straight arrow girls, but I have a couple of them at home. And that's just not where it's going to happen. You're going to have all the notebooks and all the scores in the world and learn Maseches up and down with your kids. It's not going to happen. Faith doesn't come from there. It can be part of the voice of faith, and obviously they have to see people that learn Torah and know Torah and care about Torah. So it's a very, very loaded question. And at some point, you have to start to juggle all those two. Ration, understanding, faith, trust. Don't understand, can I not? Okay. This was Rav Amital's Vart Tas Parshas B'Shalach. That's why they were given Paraduma. Or, if you want to think about it every day when you daven, Chukav U'Mishpatav L'Yisrael. Sounds like this passage. Chukav U'Mishpatav. Sham Sam Lo Chok U'Mishpat. Lo Asa Chen L'Chogai U'Mishpatim Bal Yadon. Generally, you find world religions don't have this delicate balance. Some are either hyper-rational, modern religions, secular religions. Some are hyper-mystical, hyper-irrational, ancient voodoo. Monotheism, we're pure monotheism, sits right at that center. Right at that center between. And of course, Lahavdil, other religions have also tried to calibrate, and we don't dismiss other monotheistic religions. Obviously, there are impurities in there, and one day, hopefully, they'll all become purified, and I'll say HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But one of the powers of monotheism in general, and Yiddishkeit in particular, because we've sustained monotheism. Let's face it, Christianity has seen its monotheism ebb and erode, but we've maintained this monotheism as this balance between the two. Another balance, okay, on the subject of balance, that's central to religious identity, and has to do a little bit with this, is the balance between Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. And I'm not going to have enough time to do it justice because it's 5 o'clock, but I just want to start to talk about it. We'll see how much we get. Unfortunately, next week and the week after, I'm in the States, so I want to try to get this in, okay? What is Avas Hashem? What is Yiras Hashem? And what is the relationship between the two? Okay, let's start with question number one, because it's a really important question. Because there's a mitzvah to love Hashem. How do you love something you can't see, you can't understand? I love tea, I don't, but let's say I did. But it tastes good, so I love it. So normally, we think of love about something physical that we taste, a movie that makes our heart go, I don't love clothing, but I've heard that you do. So clothing that makes you feel better about yourself when you put on a whatever physical things. Think about all the things you love in this world, and they're all physical. Hashem isn't physical. The answer to this is, and I'm just going to talk off the cuff. We don't have time to go through the Makar, because I really want to get to Yirat Shamayim. Avas Hashem means you see religion as consistent with human interests and human welfare. We've talked about this a lot. You don't see it as stifling and suffocating and I can't do this and I can't do that and I wish I could do this. That's baby religion. That's infantile religion. That's immature religion. You realize HaKadosh Baruch Hu's system is the best life I could lead. You're starting to get to that point where you realize that it's not about Schar and Onesh. It's not about pacifying an angry God. This is the best life you could lead. And even if Hashem told you there's no Olam Haba, you say, you know what? Doesn't make a difference. Because I know that if I don't follow a divine code, so again, don't couch it in extreme terms, I'll just be a drug and sex addict. No, obviously not. But Hashem gave me this beautiful world with beautiful forces and beautiful talents, and he also gave me the code book to learn how to juggle them and how to calibrate them, what to do and what, and mission and duty and abstinence and discipline and nobility and virtue, all these things that I really want to live for that fill my life with meaning, Hashem is telling me how to access them. That's called Avodas Hashem Lishma. Okay, and when you see religion that way, here's the punchline, you start to love Hashem. Because as you grow older, you love ideas that have changed your life or people whose ideas have changed your life, right? So I love my wife because we've been married for 33 years and she has changed my life. We built a family together. We each may be a better person. We've been each other's best friend. So I love her, right? Not because of the physical. I love her because of what she's done to me. I love Rev Lichtenstein. I never took a bite out of his arm. It didn't taste good. I love Rev Lichtenstein because his way of life changed my life. So I loved him abstractly. And as you grow older, your love becomes much more abstract. And the highest abstraction of love is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Well, you can't even imagine Hashem. You don't know what he is. You know, can't describe him. But you know that his system of halacha, his system of Torah and values, makes your life better. So Avas Hashem means when you understand the synchronicity between religion and life. And that's why, trick question, the only person in Tanakh to be called an Oyev Hashem is Avraham. It's a pasuk in Yeshaya, Zera Avraham Oavi, because he was the first person to realize this overlap between human interest and Hashem's will. For 2,000 years, they saw God as angry, vengeful, punitive. Avraham said, no, Hashem is the source of life. Hashem is a Baal Chesed. I want to be a Baal Chesed. It's good for your life to be an Oved Hashem. It's good for your life to accept Hashem into your world. That's why he's both an Ish Emunah and Ish HaChesed, because he couldn't just talk the talk. He had to walk the walk and just talk about a God and walk the walk. He talked about this a lot, right? So he understood the convergence. That's why he's called an Oved Hashem. Okay? Now, very briefly, what's Yiras Hashem? Yiras Hashem is that other, listen to this word, it's an important word, emotional piston. You know what a piston is? Piston is in an engine. These things go up and down and up and down and up and down. Imagine your emotional religious world is an engine, and it's being driven by two pistons. Look at the old trains. So the other piston is Yiras Hashem. Yiras Hashem is not fear. Again, poor words. Told you last time, stop translating. Abstract the concept and give yourself a word that captures it. Don't say, oh, hear, oh, Israel. Find words that are powerful, that make sense. The worst thing you do is translate from Hebrew to English. It doesn't translate. Process it and say, what does it mean? Yiras Hashem is not fear. Yiras Hashem means recognition that I can't understand Hashem. A. Part B is, and therefore I submit to his will. It's the antithesis of Avas Hashem. Avas Hashem means I understand everything about Hashem's will, not understand Hashem, but I understand how his will affects my life. It makes sense to me. And therefore I love Hashem. Because I understand, wow, my goodness, Shabbos, what do you do without Shabbos? Oh, Taras Mishpacha, what do you do without Shabbos? Oh, Kashas, what do you do without Kashas? Oh, where would my life be without a Kodesh Baruch Hu? I know where my life would be. I hope I'd be a moral, kind person, more anywhere near the life I have for myself. So thank you, Hashem, for what you gave me. Yours, Hashem, means I don't understand what you're talking about, Hashem. It doesn't make sense to me. It befuddles me. It puzzles me. I can't get it. I'm standing in Auschwitz. It doesn't make sense to me. I'm facing part. I don't understand what do you want from me, Hashem? It doesn't make sense. Why should I? But you say, you know what? Hashem is a higher will. And I can't understand him. And therefore, I just submit to him. And that's why we'll talk about this in a moment. I'll talk about it first, and I'll talk about it again in a moment. That's why, when is Avram called the Yirei Shamayim? We talked about this also earlier in the year, where? Nekeda. You can't understand. It's not meant to be a moment of understanding. Again, there are many million reasons to understand that Nekeda, but just let's simplify it. Ati Yadati, Kiri Elikimata. And you need those two. To a degree, Yirei Shamayim has to be the bedrock. Reishis Chachma, Yirei Hashem. And on top of that, you build Ava, because Ava is going to wax and wane and oscillate and waver. You will understand, you won't understand. Yirei Shamayim is the sturdy, steady foundation. That's why we talk about he's the Yirei Shamayim, she's the Yirei Shamayim. Okay? Spoiler alert for girls who live in Israel, that's the big problem facing the Dati Lumi world. We don't have enough Yirei Shamayim. In the Haredi world, there's too much Yirei Shamayim. And if Ava's Hashem, in our world, Hashem's our partner, Hashem's Achi, 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 Achi. He's also a Melech Machem Lachem, a Kadosh Baruch Hu, and it's hard to live through Geula and find Yirei Shamayim. It's not our fault, but that's where we have to improve. Okay. What about the sequence? Here's the important part, okay? Which comes first developmentally? The answer is, okay, the first step, and this is based on the Rambam, the first step is Avas Hashem, where you try to understand. And you understand. You understand more. You understand even more. And then even more. Listen to this statement. It's really important you hone in on this. It's only by trying to understand Hashem that you can fully realize that you can't understand Him. Let me put it to you in different ways, okay? It's now February 2nd. You've all been here for at least 6-7 months. Are you more ignorant or less ignorant than when you started? Depends how you ask the question. Quantitatively, you're less ignorant. But attitudinally, experientially, you're much more ignorant. Because before you started, you didn't know how little you knew. Now that you've worked at acquiring knowledge, you realize how little you know. So I tell the boys every year, you're here to become Amaratzim. So what do you mean, all this money? I said, when you start yeshiva, you're an Amaratz about the fact that you're an Amaratz. Now you'll be a Talmid Chacham about the fact that you're an Amaratz. You'll realize how little you know. It's true, right? If Einstein were in the room, let's say, who would be a bigger Amaretz about physics, me or him? In some way, he would be. Because I'm so confused about physics, I couldn't even describe what I don't know. That's how little physics I know. He could say, you know, this is the way the system works, but just don't get this idea. I don't get this phenomenon. I don't get this physical law. So the more you know, you don't know. And that's true of everything in life, but it's exponentially true about the infinite, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The more you try to discover Hashem, the more you realize you don't. So unless the process starts with an attempt to understand Hashem, with the ability to see part of Hashem, then your Yirei Shamayim is very hollow. I don't know. I don't know physics. I don't know Hashem. What do you mean you don't know Hashem? You don't even know what you don't know. So the process starts with the engagement and the understanding and the comprehension and the Abbas Hashem and the rationalization and the and then you hit that point where, oh, wow, I just don't get it. That's why the Akedah is the end of Avram's career. His whole career till that last moment is Avas Hashem. He understands, comprehends more and more. And then he gets to that last moment, he says, oh, now I realize I can't understand. But had the Akedah happened first, it'd be hollow, it'd be lame. Because you haven't even started to try to understand it. You have to start to try to understand Hashem, to gather knowledge and to accumulate comprehension and grasping, and then, okay, but as much as I know, now I know I can't know. That's why the process has to start with the desire to know and the uncovering, and then you realize, okay, but I can't fully understand Hashem. But if not, then it's just a very weak and a very empty Yiras Hashem. That same sequence between Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem is on display in this week's parsha, and you say it every morning, and hopefully, listening to me describe it to you, you'll say it differently every morning for the rest of your life. Vayar Yisrael es hayad hagidola asher asa Hashem b'Mitzrayim. Vayiru ha'am es Hashem v'yaminu b'Hashem uv'Moshe avdo. Re'ia versus Yira. Vayar Yisrael es hayad hagidola v'yiru. They saw Hashem in ways they had never seen before at the Yom Sof. So they saw and understood more of Hashem. Imagine it's just like soaking it in, getting more, drinking more, and soaking it in more. And then when they saw that much of Hashem, then they realized, oh, we just can't understand it. It's just beyond us. And then they reached Europe. Like Avram soaked in HaKadosh Baruch Hu his whole life. And then he reached the point he realized, I can't fully understand it. Hashem wanted it that way, programmed it that way. So Re'iyah, which is a substitute word for Ava, leads to Yira. Yira, okay, now listen carefully because it's a palindrome, it's a cycle. Look at my fingers, okay, I'll make it easy. Re'iyah leads to Yira. Yira preserves the integrity of Re'iyah. Because if you think you know Hashem, then you really don't know Hashem. The only way to know Hashem is to know you can't know Him. I know Hashem, 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 I don't know. Okay, now you know. Because without Yira as the check, then it becomes paganism.
Say it again.
Say it a second. Okay. but listen to the description. Because without the check and the break, then you just think you're understanding Hashem, but you're really humanizing Hashem's infinity. So Re'iyah, here's my fingers, yields Yira. Until you start to try to understand Hashem, you can't know that you don't understand Him. Yira, realizing you don't understand Him, preserves the integrity, reinforces the Re'iyah. What's the final stage of Re'iyah? What's the final lesson of the course called Knowing Hashem? No, that I don't know. If I don't know that I don't know Him, then I don't know Him. If I know that I don't know Him, then I know Him. If I don't know that final check, then I've missed the final course. I've missed the Akedah. I've missed the final check. And I think I know Him because I have 19 out of 20 courses, and I think that's Hashem, but it's a very humanized form. So the last course is, the teacher says you don't know anything. But with Hashem, it's the infinite, unknowable, you don't know anything. Not the teacher says, oh, you'll have 19 courses. In theory, if let's say I had endless amount of courses in math, and I just spend my whole life learning math, so I could cover all of math. So the teacher says, oh, you don't know anything because you learn 20 courses. Whatever, you're all ignorant. But with Hashem, I could have endless amount of courses. I would still never know because it's a conceptual realm that I can't grasp. So the final course, whatever that is, X to the nth, whatever that last course is you don't know Hashem. Even if I had the infinite course, even if that N was infinite, that last course, no matter where the infinite would be, in every other field would, okay, now I know chemistry, now I know history, now I know whatever, but I can't know Hashem. And not only can I not know Hashem quantitatively because I don't get to all that infinity, but even the things that I think I don't know because they're couched in human terms, so they're only human traces of Hashem's essence. And that's why without Re'iyah, there's no Yira. Without Yira, there's no Re'iyah. Without Ava, there's no Yira. Without Yira, there's no. And that's the calibration of this machine in life. I understand more of Hashem. If you don't understand anything about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, your Yira is very hollow. What do you mean? Who are you fearing? What are you saying you don't know about? But if you don't have any Yira, Hashem, then it's all about you and you lose transcendence. And so many people today have religion without transcendence. It's like the worst curse afflicting us. Religion has become translated into environmentalism and family life and kindness and goodness and marriage and just everything about humanity. It's also another place. It's an other with a big O. It's a thrust to another. You have to really be careful about this because this is afflicting our community. They're grounding religion. Religion is all about family, community, love, social welfare, which is about all that also. But it's also about you, standing alone on a mountain with a Kodesh Baruch Hu, listening to his will, following his ritual in a way that in no way, right? I get this all the time from kids, like, is this sugya relevant to our lives? Stop it. It's a silly question. You're going to live 100 years on this earth? Okay, so we're going to ask whether the sugya is relevant to the 100 years you'll live on this earth. But then you'll live 100 billion years on a different earth. And every word of Hashem's logic is inherently self-sufficiently relevant. So stop asking whether it's relevant. You want to ask whether it's also relevant to political theory, marriage, whatever. But you can learn, part of Hashem's logic about a twig of a grape and whether a nuzzer can or can't drink it, and you're never going to be a nuzzer, you're never going to see that twig, you're never going to... But that's Hashem's will. And in that halacha, and in that tosfos, and in that gemara, you're finding Hashem's will. And that will is something that's going to be relevant for you for your entire existence. They only love it. So just, put it into perspective. What you mean to say is, does it affect this little hotel that we're in for 100 years also? Okay, good question. Maybe yes, maybe not. But don't ever make that mistake that Torah is only relevant if it happens to talk about things that we're living through in this transient, fleeting world that's passing and going, like it's still there, but it's not relevant. Don't fall into that. Now, if you decide you want to, like I do, right? I waste a lot of my time writing articles for the Jerusalem Post. When I write articles for Jerusalem Post, I'm writing about current affairs, social issues, ethics, moral stuff. I wish I didn't. I wish I didn't have to. I wish I could just spend all my time learning Gemara all day. I feel terrible that I have to, but no one's doing it, so I feel like I have to do it. I want to get those messages out there. But if everyone believed in what I believe, they'll say, Tara, you just tell us what you should believe in. So, who needs articles? Let's learn the next Tosfos. Let's learn the next Shach. Let's learn the next Gemara. Why would I want to be writing about what I write about next week? Secular morality. It's just secular morality. Okay, I have an agenda. I'm trying to get people to be more moral. If everyone didn't need it, I'd rather learn another sugya. When I get to Shemaim, I know it's going to be the Jerusalem Post articles. They will ask me, do you know that Tosfos? And I want to try to understand it. So just make sure you preserve transcendence. Okay, there's some Murray Sachs in one of his chapters has a great quote. I wish I had another great partnership. The great tragedy of a life without transcendence. Some woman, like really, really good quote, powerful quote. If I see it next time, if you look at one of the chapter headings, it's got two or three quotes before each chapter of the great partnership. Where else did this happen? Well, this will end. Where else did this sequence happen? So the Gemara tells the story, and you may have heard the story or not, about Shimon Hamsuni. It's a quote in the Gemara in, where is it here? It's the last source. Okay? He was so adroit and so adept that he darshaned every extra word in the Torah. Every time the Torah is an extra word, S, my favorite, Kaved Es Avicha V'Yasimecha, what do we darshan? Honor your parents and your older sibling. Yes. Okay? Kaved Es Avicha V'Yasimecha. I'm sorry to all the younger siblings. Yes. Kaved Es Avicha V'Yasimecha. You have to honor your older sibling. Whatever. Darshan every single S. He came to one S. Listen carefully. If you get this, you make the first part seem easy. This is even harder. So he got to the S that he couldn't darshan. What was the S he couldn't darshan? S Hashem Elokecha Tira. Didn't have a drasha. What else can I include in your Hashemayim? You hear what I said? What else can I include in your Hashemayim? What else should you fear? Not fear. What else should you approach with the same your attitude that you should darshan? So his Talmidim said, Rabbi, basically, if the system is incomplete, because you got 99, but you didn't get that last S in, do you see it as a failure? You know, you really have to follow this. It's going to be very complicated, but I know you girls, because you're all such smart girls and get it. Okay, now you got to use your brains, okay? Now it's not really important, but you got to use it. So he says to them, Kishem shekibalti schar ala drisha, kachani makabel schar ala prisha. Now, the wrong way to read this Gemara is, yeah, I tried. I get points for trying, I get points for the success, and I get a medal for trying. And today everyone comes home with a medal. Everyone on the team gets a medal. So I get 99 points for getting it right. And the one S that I didn't get, I tried, you know. But I'm honest enough to not to make up something, not to fabricate something. Right? Wrong. Listen carefully. That last drasha that he didn't get was not incidental. It reinforced the meaning. Because what is Yirat Shamayim? Say it to me, not fear, but knowing you don't understand Hashem. Is there anything else you can apply that to? Can you stretch it to include anything else? No. It's a unique Ava. You can compare the love of Hashem to other loves. Shir Shir, man and woman. Yira, you can't compare. That's a uniquely Hashem experience. It can't apply to anything else because I can understand everything else. In theory, I may not understand nuclear physics, but if I were smart enough, I would. But everything else is comprehensible. Because Hashem isn't. So his prisha was really drisha. The only way he could darshan and elaborate and explain Yira was being parish. Kishem shekibalti schar al hadrisha kach kibalti schar al prisha, because the prisha in this case was the drisha. And it was the last one. The prisha was after all the drisha. The drisha is the ava, the understanding of Hashem's Torah. The prisha was, I can't understand this one part because it's built into the experience of Yerushalayim, but I can't understand. That's what Yerushalayim is, I can't understand. So there's no way I can start to explain and extrapolate and start to give drashas for Yirat Shamayim, because Yirat Shamayim means I can't understand Hashem. So of course I can't extend it to anything else. So he didn't say, oh, I tried my hardest, give me a point for effort. No, this is a hundred. This is a score of 100. I darshan 99, and I darshan the last one by not darshaning it. I can darshan, and it was the last one. And it had to be the last one, because if it weren't the last one, then I wouldn't know that I can't understand Hashem, because I wouldn't try to understand Hashem. Without the Riyah, really, I couldn't have Yira. Without the Ava, I couldn't have Yira. Without the Drisha, I couldn't have Drisha. It's the same sequencing, stacked three times. Avraham, Yamsuf, and Shimon Hamsuni. And us, every day of our lives. Every day of our lives. And if you get this right, I can't say this more strongly, you will get religion right. It's hard. But if you get it right, you get it right. Loosely taken, it's intellect versus submission. It's piety versus creativity. It's this world versus transcendence. This duality cuts across almost every single balancing act of religion. And you can just see in our world people migrating to the poles, one without the other. Thinking they know Hashem, turning Hashem to their kid brother, like I said before. Or turning Hashem into someone who just have no relationship because he's so beyond me. People of overwhelming piety, but not necessarily creativity. And people of tremendous problem here in these institutions. Creativity. Where's the piety? Okay, so great. You can tell me 13 different ways to reach Moel Bet. Woo. Tell me, you're able to sit in front of Hashem and pour your heart. You're able to keep Shabbos carefully. You're able to, right? How do you build those two? Piety and reverence versus creativity. It's almost every single part of religion is this balancing act between the two. Right? The Vilna Gaon once was asked by his Star Talmud, who was the Star Talmud of Vilna Gaon? Chaim Voloshin. Chaim Voloshin built the first modern yeshiva. All modern yeshivas come from those yeshivas. It's Chaim Yeshiva Voloshin, 1803. So the Chaim Voloshin once asked the Vilna Gaon, should I take the following project? And I forget what the project was. So the Vilna Gaon told him, I'll teach you a little Yiddish. Nisht. Dibista kluger nishta firmer. Klug means smart, firm means bias. So he says, you shouldn't. You're smart, you're not firm. Like, what do you mean? It's a plain philosophy, you're not firm. What the only thing I was saying is that, think about it. Some people are born, everyone is born with one central trait. And the wisdom in life is to know what trait you have naturally and not stay within that cage, but find the trait you don't have naturally and build it. Some people are born naturally pious. Do you know people like that? Maybe it's you. I don't know you well enough. But that's their inner core. How do you see it? Just, you see it. Halacha dictates their lives. They want to follow. They want to submit. They want to pour roi motion. They want to, very straight, simple, clear, binary. Some people's center of gravity is wisdom, knowledge, sophistication. I'm like that. The challenge in life is to find what you are, but not be trapped by that and try to build the other part. Now, what the Vilna Gaon was telling Chaim Voloshin is, okay, your natural place is you're a smart guy, you're smarty pants. You're pretty firm also. But this particular job, it's better to have whatever, the other person. I don't know the story. I know what the job was, just the story. Think of Shlomo and David. David was a firmer. Shlomo was a kluger. David's the worst poet ever. He's not a poet. He's not a poet. He's writing pure. What should you not do? I read a lot of poetry in my life. What should you not do when you write poetry? You should never, ever finish the metaphor. Leave it empty. Leave it open-ended so that it can invite multiple meanings. If I say, my wife asked me, let's say, I respond to my wife, how was Shir today in Migdal HaOz? I say, it was like a glorious sunrise on a breaking horizon. So that means I like the girls and I like the experience and it was radiant and whatever. 13 different meanings. You never want to finish the metaphor. It was like a beautiful radiant sunrise because it was orange. Like, no. Leave it. Leave it vague. Leave it inviting. Leave it multi-tiered. That's what poetry is. The complexity of life. Overlapping ideas. David Melech is always finishing his phrase. Don't. Just leave it. You'll be like a tree on the waterbed. No. Shem was a great poet. Every phrase in Shir Hashirim is a dangling metaphor. Just read. Like, every phrase is great poetry. David's not writing poems. He's writing hymns. It's pure, raw. Hashem, I need you. I need you like this. I need you like this. I want you like this. Now, you got to make sure, though, that piety comes first, even if you're a clue. They each wake up in the morning when they fail, and their failures are pretty similar. They're all sexual-oriented, David and Bathsheba, Shlomo with his Egyptian Moabite wives. And David looks in the mirror and recoils. He says, I'm a monster. I better do something about it. Shlomo looks in the mirror and goes like this. Taina, it's necessary diplomatically. He's smarty pants, too good, too smart for his own good. He never does tshuva. Well, at least we don't see the tshuva. Because David says, Reishis Chachma, Yiras Hashem. What does Shlomo say? Reishis Chachma, Kenei Chachma. He never gets out of the Chachma land. Too much Chachma. You know what you are. I imagine most people in our world, if you're sitting in this room, you're probably the Chacham people. That's where we're raised. Okay, so now you got a lot of work to do. You got to meet people who are inner Frumkeit. You got to appreciate people. You want to marry someone like that. Don't marry yourself. That's the first thing in the world. Don't marry a male version of yourself in pants. Marry someone who compliments. Like, what do you not have? Psychologically, developmentally, religiously. You'll know it. You'll feel it. If you're attuned enough, you'll start to feel, oh, this person gives me, and hopefully you'll make that assessment, not just emotionally and psychologically, you'll also make it religiously. This person gives me religiously something I don't have. Hopefully it'll all come together. Hopefully psychology, religion, because you're a religious girl, so hopefully it's all wrapped up. It's not like, oh, I want to segment them. What is it going to be emotionally? Right? I hate when I interview boys on Judaic studies. Not Judaic studies, it's you. It's your identity. Like, your religion is you. That should be anathema brachah. You don't have a you without religion. It doesn't exist. It can't exist. It shouldn't exist. I practice religion. I'm not practicing religion. That's what you live for. That's what you engage in. That's your identity. It's part of whom you are. Like, take religion out of me, I'm dead. I'm just like you. I like melt like the Wicked Witch of the West. There's no me here without religion. There's no. So that's why Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem are so vital, because it hits almost every single point on the horizon. Piety, reverence, transcendence, here, world, just close to Hashem, long distance. And in our world, of course, is just a little too much Avas Hashem, because, face it, we feel like we're partnering with Hashem in Gula, and we're so excited to be partnering with Hashem, and partner. And Hashem's not your partner. He's also your partner, but he's also Melech Malchein Lachem. And you have to be careful, like, when to, how to strike that balance, right? At my daughter's wedding, okay? It was crazy. You should see the videos. They were jumping and dancing and singing and whatever. Okay, it was amazing under the chuppah. Not exactly my way of going about things, but that's not the issue. It's not about me. I could care less. I want her to be the happiest person on the earth, and that night I'm happy. But my father-in-law was making the bracha. He's in the clip, and I mean, Rav Meidan was dancing like Michael Jackson. I mean, it was just moonwalking. The whole place was jumping and moving. And someone pulled my father-in-law to get him to dance. You're making a bracha. Sing Hashem's name. You don't say Hashem's name. Everyone else, keep going. Michael Jackson, up and down. You're saying a bracha. Saying Kodesh Baruch Hu's name. Right? You'll never see me in shul. Okay, here's a great way, okay? Because davening is not about what's in here. Because you can't control what's in there. Davening is about what's in here. Your body, your posture, your I will never sit in shul during davening, during the haftarah, I'm naked. But I will never sit in shul like this. And I've seen my kids sit in shul like that. It's just not mechavadik. Sitting in front of the bar in shul, I'm going to sit like that. I have a bench like this. Making a bracha. Okay, I put my jacket on for bench, and that's my mishigas. Yeah, yeah. Making a bracha. Do you have that ability to be omed lifnei Hashem? And to like zone in and say, okay, it's not all just the dancing and the casual and the, okay, then you can't be too stiff. You have to find a way to also make it. It has to work with your world, and Hashem has to be. How do you do that? How do you create that balance? It has to be a balance, and you have to constantly check yourself and ask, is it too much here, too much there, too little here, too much there? Every person's different, obviously. Like, don't judge a person because their expressions, but do you have that little internal, almost like a little ball, you know, those little gyrating balls that, you know, go back and forth in all directions, and in the middle of some system keeps a balance. Like, what do they call the eagle? And the eagle has a natural, there's something in a plane, like a little ball that keeps you in the plane. It's a navigational tool, and the eagle has it internally. Like, it's called gyroscopic ability to like be flying this way, but to see the earth this way. There's some tool that, like, the eagle, like, going like this or soaring down, but it's still always like looking straight and always like them. I have to look at this, but eagles have a very, very, eagles and hawks. And so, like, now that little ball that keeps it all. You ever seen planes? These old planes actually have a little ball that. What, gyroscope?
I think it's a gyroscope.
They have an internal gyroscope. Ride the heavens on a gyroscope, girls. Ride the heavens on a gyroscope. Okay. Have a good Shabbos, girls. Don't forget to ride the heavens, though. Yes.
How would you work on something?